नमस्ते। आई थिंक स्टार ऑन है ऐसा उसने बोला। ऑन है ये, पर ऑन है ना? हाँ ठीक है। नमस्ते। Who is Sri Aurobindo? And there is no simple answer. If answer there can be to this question. Even his human personality is so fascinating. Such a multifaceted genius. And to speak about his divine personality is truly nothing short of diminishing him, because what human tongue can utter about someone who had scaled all the heights and depths of the creation? And not only he had scaled, he could express it in an unparalleled language and with this complete mastery and command. So to speak about Sri Aurobindo is actually in a sense an exercise which doesn't really take us deep into understanding who he is. And yet this exercise is very fruitful, because when we speak about Sri Aurobindo or listen about Sri Aurobindo, then we grow in joy. That's how it is said in our scriptures that the first steps towards bhakti are shravan, manan. So when we hear about Sri Aurobindo, it is itself helps us to grow in some kind of nearness to him. But to understand him, to know him, the mother says, is impossible, because he is vast as the universe and his teaching is infinite. And the only way to know him a little, to come closer to him a little, is through love and service and giving oneself unreservedly to his work. So I suppose even to speak on Sri Aurobindo, this is the minimum qualification. The mother has given us a hint. Any amount of reading of Sri Aurobindo is not enough. One has to have love and one has to have service. So with this little background and the fact that when biographers tried to write something on Sri Aurobindo's life, Sri Aurobindo clearly remarked that it is he alone who can give significance to the events in his life. So when a biographer insisted, in fact, there is a biographer whose name was Dhurandhar or Dhundur, who wanted to write his biography, and Sri Aurobindo humorously remarked, playing a little pun on the name, that who is this Dhurandhar? And then he says, it's okay. Finally, he concedes if he wants to write a biography, and if I have to be murdered in cold print, then let it not be by my disciples. So, you know, it's so significant. So what is this book about Sri Aurobindo on himself and the ashram? Well, Sri Aurobindo never wrote anything on himself. He was never writing. He was, in fact, quite reticent to speak about himself. Generally, he would stay in the background. He would hardly speak about himself, never liked to be in the forefront, even when we see the freedom movement. And yet, how far can the Brahma Kamal, the heavenly lotus, hide from the sight of humanity? That is how Sri Aurobindo got known. Though even now, people do not know not only who Sri Aurobindo is, but what Sri Aurobindo has done. It's a bit of an irony. Just as till today people, and I can only draw a parallel, just as till today people wonder whether Krishna is a myth or not. And the other day when someone asked me this question, I said, tell me one single human being who has had such a tremendous influence on art, culture, dance, music, philosophy, spiritual movements, festivity, and human relationships. Even there are, you know, things like Rakhi and Holi, which are dedicated to Krishna. I said, than Sri Krishna, one person. It's not about the number of followers. Like people often say, you know, Christ has so many followers and, you know, Islam has so many followers. That is irrelevant. but the number of movements that Sri Krishna's influence inspired. And yet, many would say he was a myth. Maybe after 100 years, 500 years, 1000 years, who knows, people would wonder whether there was really one person by the name of Sri Aurobindo. And yet we see that there is so many movements that he has inspired, he has initiated right from India's revolution, participated in the Second World War and opened a path for the future, revealed the truth of the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Gita extensively, and guided and continues to guide thousands and thousands of disciples all around the world. So all this about Sri Aurobindo, and but he never wrote anything about himself. He used to remain in the background. So this book is actually a compilation of letters that he wrote to different disciples who asked him specific questions. Some of them were when somebody wrote on Sri Aurobindo and wanted him to take a look whether it's correct or not, and Sri Aurobindo made corrections. But frankly, I have not understood the logic behind the arrangement of this volume, because this volume in a certain sense is supposed to be a continuation or a descent from the volume in Sri Aurobindo Birth Centenary Library, that is 1972 series of volumes, where there was a volume called Sri Aurobindo on himself. A marvelous book. If you read it from beginning to end, you don't feel like leaving it. And besides, it awakened in us a deep respect, admiration, love, everything for Sri Aurobindo. But for some reason, and of course I can give reasons, but that's really not relevant. Maybe the way it has been arranged with the mental consciousness of someone, whereas that book was a spontaneous flowing out of someone who had genuine love and admiration for Sri Aurobindo under the guidance of the mother, that one doesn't feel so well connected with this volume as it was with the same volume in SABCL. The name has been slightly changed, so that was only Sri Aurobindo on himself. This is Sri Aurobindo on himself and the ashram. Lot of new letters have been brought in, some context have been brought in, some are half is here, half is in autobiographical note. Some letters are partly here, partly in letters on yoga. So it doesn't really, the arrangement seems at times very illogical and very difficult. It's like scattered. Somebody has written it in a scattered state of consciousness, probably for academic purposes. So that apart, yet there are plenty of letters of Sri Aurobindo, and Sri Aurobindo's letters are always beautiful to read, always uplifting. And when we have gone through the volume, we do have a kind of a comprehensive view of all that Sri Aurobindo has spoken about himself. So this book has number of parts. There are 5 parts at least in this particular volume, and I'll just read out some of these parts. For instance, there is the first part, which is primarily about remarks on his life and works and on his contemporaries and contemporary events. It's a very big blanket chapter. So it becomes very mixed up. So remarks on his life, events in his outer life, and then his works and on his contemporaries and contemporary events. So contemporaries and contemporary events that were happening. So we'll have a whole set of things here. And while it's okay, they have been brought in under one umbrella, as I said, there is a interlacing of many things together. And part 2 is his sadhana or practice of yoga, which is seen from, so this is in context of certain specific disciples. Whereas letters on yoga is also about sadhana, but they are more general letters. And here they have given the questionnaires question also. So to that extent, it is a good thing. And part 3 is the leader and the guide. So as the guru, the avatar, help in difficulties. Part 4, the practice of yoga in the ashram and outside. And part 5 is mantra and messages. So this is what this volume consists of. And let me now come straight to some of the selections which I have made to share, and as I said, for the joy of it. So people have an image of Sri Aurobindo, and that image is normally based on the Darshan Day photograph or the image, which is the 1920 photograph or a little before, where he looks like an ascetic. There is a photograph of before 1920 actually, where he looks more like an ascetic. The mother has remarked about that. A lot of people like it because it reminds them of Christ who has sacrificed himself at the cross. But that's not what Sri Aurobindo is. It doesn't, far from it, far from capturing his totality. Then we have a 1920 photograph, which is sparkling, and one can feel the sense of infinity in his eyes, the power in his gaze. And then a long period in which there is no photograph, and there is 1950, when we have the royal majestic photograph, where he looks like his gaze is commanding the whole universe. So based on these photographs and the high uplifting writings, especially the Life Divine, so it looks like here is somebody who is sitting on some Himalayan grandeur. And instantly the sense is that we cannot approach him. He is too high, too majestic, too much above anything in the world. How can we approach him? And we have Sri Aurobindo's own letters, which is defying this notion. For instance, he says in one of his letters, "Oh, rubbish." This is a letter to Dilip Kumar Roy. "I am austere and grand." People had this idea. And even now people start following, imitating Sri Aurobindo. They start wearing a dhoti, start shutting them inside a room. "Don't meet, don't look up," as if Sri Aurobindo is that. And as if by imitating, even if he was that, as if by imitating we can arrive at. We forget that Sri Aurobindo led a full life, both mother and Sri Aurobindo. And the sacrifice, the wrestle, the battle was all going on inside. He was not telling to the world what is going on inside. He was married, he was into politics, he did a job, he taught, he studied, and everything he did with an excellence. And yet his life had an inner dimension, even outwardly a battle, because we see that how the British government, and even as a child, he says that living in near poverty in England, because there was a whole period when he had just enough amount of money to take one sausage in the morning and a cup of tea. That's all. And it's not that he was practicing any fasting. It's simply because there was no money. And with one coat, he had to go through the entire period in England. So this was the aspect of his life as a battle. Imagine somebody comes at Apollo Bandar after returning, foreign return. So what do you expect? One, people with full mala and everything, And of course, after the initial Shuddhikaran, as used to be there in the ancient times, if you came from the West, it was understood that your consciousness has got corrupted. So you have to take a bath, a ritual. And I do understand that, why people would have thought so. And then after that, you can go in. Now, of course, they do band baja barat, and also, in addition, parents, they would be so happy. Now here is Sri Aurobindo landing on Apollo Bandar, and he is greeted by none else but Mother India. And what does she put? A garland of calm. "A calm descended upon me." That's how Sri Aurobindo describes. Vast calm. She greets him. And then what about parents? Mother had lost her head. Father died just 2 days before Sri Aurobindo has come, because he got a wrong telegram that, the ship has sunk. So we can imagine what would have been his state. And then after coming here again, living in Baroda, though he is married, he has stayed away. He hardly had any married life, and all kinds of food, whatever the cook made, he had to eat it. And then, of course, we know the revolutionary movement, wherein the jail, and in the jail, the sword hanging over his neck. And then when he comes out, he goes to Pondicherry, where again we see that with very little money, he is continuing the work, and that work is not at all an ordinary, rather even to say it extraordinary is to belittle it. That is the kind of work that Sri Aurobindo continued to do. So all this he experienced in his life, and people had this idea that he is austere and grand, grim and stern. And then with this characteristic humor, he says, "I am austere and grand, grim and stern, every blasted thing that I never was. I groan in an Aurobindonian despair when I hear such things. He says, this is the image you people have made about me. What has happened to the common sense of all of you people? In order to reach the overmind, it is not at all necessary to take leave of this simple but useful quality, which is common sense. Common sense, by the way, is not logic, which is the least common sense-like thing in the world. Look at the humor. With logic, you can prove anything. Actually, you can literally prove, and I have heard people proving, using logic, that how what is written in a holy book is right, that the sun rises and sets in the same place. That's, you can prove it, because actually, technically, yes. Technically, if I look at with my gross vision, sun rises in Pondicherry, it sets also in Pondicherry. So you can literally say it is sunset. So you are technically, you can say that you are correct. So logic can prove anything. So he says the least commonsensical like thing. It is simply looking at things as they are without inflation or deflation, not imagining wild imaginations, or for that matter, despairing, I know not why, despairs. And then he corrects this, see, after remarking about him, he corrects this notion that he was somebody who never smiled in this way. The divine may be difficult, but his difficulties can be overcome if one keeps at him. Even my smilelessness was overcome, which Nevinson had remarked with horror more than 20 years before, because he saw he was absorbed in his inner meditation. So when he saw him in the court, he remarked that he is a man who never smiles. It had nothing to do with grimness or sternness. He was so self-absorbed in that state of blissful experience of Vasudev everywhere. And therefore, he had concluded, Nevinson, the most dangerous man in India, Aurobindo Ghosh, the man who never smiles. And Sri Aurobindo says, he ought to have added, but who always jokes. Shivinda had a wonderful sense of humor. But he did not know that, as I was very solemn with him. Or perhaps I had not developed sufficiently on that side then. Anyhow, if you could overcome that, you are bound to overcome all the other difficulties also. And then he finally says, the mistake was an old obstinate suggestion returning so as to bring about the old reactions which have to be got over. It is your old error of the greatness and grimness of God. So we are instilled, God is great and is grim, is serious. He doesn't like music, he doesn't like art, he doesn't like sculpture, he doesn't like architecture. All that he wants is quietly pray for him, seriously. This is how you have to pray. You better pray. And if you commit a mistake, blasphemy against him, he will punish you, roast you in hell. This is the notion. And from that, we also have developed. This was not how Sanatana Dharma was. Shiva is so loving, even though he is austere and grand, literally. And Krishna is so playful and joking. I mean, I can't imagine conception of a god like Krishna. And yet, somewhere we drew that other notion and it got superimposed upon our mind. So he says that this is what brings back the wrong ideas and the gloom. Like people say, mother gets angry, how would Sri Aurobindo look at it? All these are our own notions, not all this talk about grimness and sternness is sheer rot. Now look at now Sri Aurobindo. He has used the word rot. It's not a bad word. It's a good word. I mean, people use it. But look at Sri Aurobindo's gentlemanliness. Mother said that he is a thorough gentleman. He says, all this is sheer rot. You will excuse me for the expression, but there is no other that is adequate. So he used the word rot. And he says, I'm sorry I have to use this expression. Because there is nothing else which is, proper. So this is how he says. He says people who don't smile are like Stalin and Mussolini, who are grim and earnest. In fact, at one place he says in one of his aphorisms, a god who never smiles could not have created this wonderful world, amusing world. And then of course, there are letters which clarify a lot of doubts For example, people often use this spiritual, he has used the word supramental, but basically he has just only qualified spiritual. It is the same thing, spiritual. But he has used the word supramental, like somebody else may use some other word. And Shubindo reminds us in a letter, if spiritual and supramental were the same thing, look how he is, you know, with that appealing to our even common sense. Then all the sages and devotees and yogis and sadhaks throughout the ages would have been supramental beings. And all I have written about the supermind would be so much superfluous rubbish. Anybody who had spiritual experiences would then be a supramental being. The ashram would be chock full of supramental beings, and every other ashram in India also. So they are two distinct terms, naturally, and Shubindo is a jadugar of everything, and he is a jadugar of words also. So his words are very precise. I have not seen one person using words with such precision and with such finish. Even the most commonplace word, by a usage, he would change it, or it becomes so sublime. As I said, one of them being loiters, in nature's instrument, loiters, secret God, and many such words, even in Savitri. So he explains, and that we can omit for now, because there are other places where he has explained this at great length. Then people would ask that, what is the difference between this yoga and others? Even now people say that, it is the same thing like Yoga of the Gita. They even bring out passages from Yoga of the Gita and draw a comparison. Now, what they forget is that there are many commonalities. If you compare even God with a human being, when God assumes a human form, so you will say, what is the difference? Both have two eyes, one nose, one mouth, two ears, two legs, two hands. That's how one will describe. But the difference is not in this. There is a world of difference which we are completely ignoring. So when we compare the Gita and Sri Aurobindo's yoga, the Vedas and Sri Aurobindo, the Upanishad and Sri Aurobindo, there are things that we miss out. There are many common things. There will be common things like conquest of desire, mastery over the ego, annulling the ego, equanimity. They are all common things to any true spiritual practice. But there are differences which we need to reckon with. So here is a letter where he says, it is new as compared with the old yogas. One, because it aims not at a departure out of world and life into a heaven or a nirvana, but at a change of life and existence. So first thing is, goal is different. So very often when people, I've had this situation when they say that, what is written in the Upanishads, what is written in the Gita, same thing is in Sri Aurobindo. So I ask this one simple question. And they quote this yogi, that Baba. Now everybody is right. It's not about any of these things. So I ask them that, what is the product that finally they are giving? A very business-like attitude, I know, but that's the only thing which goes home. Moksha, yes. But moksha is something I don't want. What do you want? I say that what I want is what Sri Aurobindo is giving. Now it's a fact. Through all the spiritual history so far, we keep hearing about salvation in the beyond, a secure place in heaven, or moksha. These are the three basic aims which have been put forward as the highest. But for Sri Aurobindo, moksha is a step and not the conclusion of the journey. So he says that because it aims not at a departure out of world and life into heaven or a nirvana, but at a change of life and existence, not as something subordinate or incidental, but as a distinct and central object. So he says it is not just that there would be some change, because some change takes place in all yogas. All yogis, every person who is aspiring for spiritual life, most of them will develop some kind of an inner change. This is bound to happen, some kind of peacefulness, quietude, the reactions, but that is not transformation. Sri Aurobindo clarifies that. Two, because the object sought after is not an individual achievement of divine realization for the sake of the individual, but something to be gained for the earth consciousness. So this also, here we see that in all yogas, the aim ultimately is individual, And if at all you include the society, like there are movements which speak about Janaseva, Naraseva is Narayan Seva. But what do they do really? They either have their teaching schools where they ultimately teach Vedanta and the path to moksha, or else they have free hospitals, free schools, etc., etc. But that is not the goal. The goal here is a collective transformation of mankind so that there can be a divine life established upon earth. What is meant is very simple. It's not about opening a free hospital, but giving man, empowering man to learn to heal from within and in a radical way by that ultimate power, the yogic force, how it can make us write, how it can make us speak, how it can make us how it can be activated in every sphere of human life, a change of the way we look at human relationships. And now this aspect is slowly coming in. But the goal which has been presented is individual moksha in traditional paths. And three, because a method has been preconized for achieving this purpose, which is as total and integral as the aim set before it. So meaning thereby that the method is not just meditation, not just bhakti, not just karma yoga. It is all these things, but something else, something more. It's a package, comprehensive package, which includes every aspect of human existence. And then Sri Aurobindo says, if I had, I have not found this method as a whole or anything like it proposed or realized in the old yogas. If I had, I should not have wasted my time in hewing out paths and in 30 years of search and inner creation, when I could have hastened home safely to my goal in an easy canter over paths already blazed out, laid down, perfectly mapped, macadamized, made secure in public. So very clearly, Sri Aurobindo says that there are new elements. Again, what are those new elements? Everything is not here. Here only is saying goal is different. It's not individual but collective. At the same time, there is a method which is different, which he describes over the other volumes. Now there are some interesting remarks that Sri Aurobindo gave about many world personalities. And one of them I thought I'll take out, because we often use in the same breath, is about Gandhi. Okay, so hold our breath. Most of the spiritual leaders of that time, yogis, did not have a very kindly observation about Gandhi. Now it's different that many things are coming to light. And we have used him just like the church has used Christ, canonized him, worship him to get money and influence. Christ is Christ. But here, Gandhi is not even very far from that. Though he is a Christian by his temperament, and yet his name is used on the money, that note, and everywhere else to get votes. Now that apart, but what about Gandhi, Sri Aurobindo's view? Actually, he wanted to come and have Sri Aurobindo's darshan. So Sri Aurobindo refused. He gave some reason. And then somebody insisted that maybe he will change by discovering that there is something beyond. And Sri Aurobindo said, no, this is not likely to happen. And when Vinoba Bhave had come, and Vinoba Bhave had a very interesting opening. When Gandhiji wrote to him about his experiments with truth, I don't want to qualify it further. So he said, I don't agree with all this, your experiments about brahmacharya and experiments with truth, but I don't want to discuss it further and I want to keep silent on the subject. So that Vinoba Bhave, when he had come, mother was very happy meeting him, gave some nice that you are doing a good work, Bhudan, and you continue doing it. And then he asked for Sri Aurobindo's life divine signed by Sri Aurobindo for Gandhiji. Sri Aurobindo smiled and said, I don't think he will read it. But if you are asking, I am giving it to you. He gave it. And when he gave to Gandhiji, he said, I don't think I will read or understand it. And he passed it to somebody else. So why? What was the problem? Because, you know, we hear so much. But there is another side which we need to see. Now, this is from the divine vision point of view. As for Gandhi, why should you suppose that I am so tender for the faith of the Mahatma? I do not call it faith at all, but a rigid mental belief. And what he terms soul force is only a strong vital will which has taken a religious turn. What a threadbare analysis. That, of course, can be a tremendous force for action. But unfortunately, Gandhi spoils it by his ambition to be a man of reason, while in fact, he has no reason in him at all. Never was reasonable at any moment in his life, and I suppose never will be. And now when we look back at Noah Khali and his responses, saying that no, you people should not, even if they come, marry your woman. And even, in fact, at one point he goes on to say, if the Muslims kill all the Hindus and take over the land, you should allow it. You will usher a new creation that way. Now, look at him. He says, never was reasonable. Anybody with a little common sense can understand it is one of the most unreasonable statements by any standard that one can ever hear. And yet, we worship him, do the full mala and all. I think time has come to regard that well. We don't accept him as the father of the nation, whatever it be. And as I keep saying, father of the nation is Rama, Krishna, Aurobindo. And if you go far back time, the Rishi is who had the vision of Bharat Mata. So he says, never will be. What he has in its place is a remarkable type of unintentionally sophistic logic, not sophisticated. He's a sophist who almost like a, you know, bare ascetic and trying to goat milk and charkha and sleep on the floor, that kind of logic. Well, what this reason, this amazingly precisely unreliable logic brings about is that nobody is ever sure. And I don't think he's himself really sure what he will do next. He has not only two minds, but three or four minds. And all depends on which will turn up topmost at a particular moment and how it will combine with the others. And we know how much India has suffered and continues to suffer. And yet, this is a paradox that people at whose hands we have suffered, we eulogize them and put them on a pedestal. So why did the British leave? Well, it was the conditions had become such. Gandhi or no Gandhi, they would have gone. There was nothing left for them. This country was no more, they had looted what they could loot. It had become unlivable with all the revolt and all around, people were unhappy. There was famine, they had plundered everything. And after Second World War, they had neither the means nor the resources to manage India. And what they did along with Gandhi to India, just as an aside, just compare the map of India post-Mahabharat. It is all there on the internet. The map of India during Mughals and the map of India post the British Raj. And you will see what they have done. Nothing else is required. So this is, he is very clear about. There would be no harm in that. On the contrary, there might be an advantage. If there were a central light somewhere choosing for him and shaping the decision to the need of the action. He thinks there is and calls it God. But it has always seemed to me that it is his own mind that decides, and most of the time decides wrongly. So this, you know, voice of God, all this I am hearing, one should be so wary of that. So he says that he decides with his mind and calls it the voice of God. He thinks there is and calls it God. Anyhow, I cannot imagine Lenin or Mustafa Kemal not knowing their own minds or acting in this way. Even their strategic retreats were steps towards an end clearly conceived and executed. Now you see whose name he is bringing together. Lenin and Mustafa Kemal. They are nothing else but aspiric beings. And Aurobindo is not saying anything directly. He says, at least they have a clear mind. This is Aurobindo's beautiful way of saying. But at the end he does say that, well, but whatever it be, it is all mind and action and vital force in Gandhi. So why should he be taken as an example of the defeat of the divine or of a spiritual power? I quite allow that there has been something behind Gandhi greater than himself. And you can call it the divine or a cosmic force which has used him. But then there is that behind everybody who is used as an instrument for world ends. Behind Kemal and Lenin also. So that is not germane to the matter. That's why when we see that later message, when Gandhi has left the body, was killed, and Sri Aurobindo gave a message, the light that led India to freedom continues to lead. So people took it as if he's saying very highly of Gandhi. He was revealing a very beautiful truth that, well, there is a light that led, and it used Gandhi as an instrument, and he'll continue to lead India. But it was done in such a sophisticated way, and there are people, you know, who have quoted that piece, circulate that, see this, how just like people keep quoting the mother invited Nehru and she had very high opinion of Nehru. Now if you read through, you will see how she looked at the whole thing. So here he has made it very clear, and then person asks, it's Govind Bhai Patel mostly, yesterday I thought how nice it would be if Gandhiji came here for the truth which he is seeking. At times he hears some voice, he says. And Sri Aurobindo's reply, I don't think he would accept the truth that is here. His mind is too rigid for it. This is a very vast, many-sided plastic truth. Well, and it goes on. There are a number of letters on, and he says, the view taken by the Mahatma in these matters, caste and all that, is Christian rather than Hindu. For the Christians, self-abasement, humility, the acceptance of a low status to serve humanity or the divine are things which are highly spiritual and the noblest privilege of the soul. You know, often there is that, you know, I am the biggest sinner. It is regarded as a great quality. But in India, we don't say that. We say, aham brahmasmi, which sounds very egoistic. But that is the deepest truth. Sin belongs to, as Mother has said, to the old world. It doesn't belong to yoga. We have to remind ourselves of the deepest truth. Yes, we may roll in the mud, but that's not what we are. So he says that, well, he is more of a Christian by temperament. And perhaps that's why the British could gel with him and he could understand them. They could understand. And it suited their purpose to put him as the leader. And this they do always. Whether it be Osama bin Laden now in a different context. It's a very old way of the Western world that it puts leaders who will serve their purposes. They will be his master's voice. At the same time, they will allow them to do the agitation and whatever it is, knowing this is less harmful than, let's say, someone else. Okay. Enough of Gandhiji. There are remarks on many leaders in this, in the same vein. Then about the Second World War, where Sri Aurobindo intervened. There is a very interesting letter. You have said that you have begun to doubt whether it was the mother's war. Sri Aurobindo is saying, you have said to a disciple, and ask me to make you feel again that it is. I affirm again to you, see how well Sri Aurobindo was saying. This was a time when Gandhi and Inc. did not look at it like that. Britishers are India's enemy, and they are Germany is Britain's enemy. Shatru ka Shatru Mitra. On that principle of Panchatantra, Subhas Bose operated. And Shubhinder said it is very dangerous. Gandhiji and all said, if Hitler comes, let him come and occupy. But we will not give our hearts to him. Hitler would have found no better place than to enter like this. And they did not support the British because they thought that Britishers are our enemy. But at this point of time, a whole world civilization was at stake. It was not about British at all. And so when Sri Aurobindo contributed to the war fund, many people didn't understand why he's doing so. So here he gives the reason that I affirm again to you most strongly that this is the mother's war. You should not think of it as a fight for certain nations against others or even for India. It is a struggle for an ideal that has to establish itself on earth in the life of humanity, for a truth that has yet to realize itself fully and against a darkness and falsehood that are trying to overwhelm the earth and mankind in the immediate future. It is the forces behind the battle that have to be seen and not this or that superficial circumstance. It is no use concentrating on the defects or mistakes of nations. All have defects and commit serious mistakes. But what matters is on what side they have ranged themselves in the struggle. It is a struggle for the liberty of mankind to develop, for conditions in which men have freedom and room to think and act according to the light in them and grow in the truth grow in the spirit. There cannot be the slightest doubt that if one side wins, there will be an end of all such freedom and hope of light and truth, and the work that has to be done will be subjected to conditions which would make it humanly impossible. And that what explains when many of us people speak about Islam. Why? Because if it were to rule the world, it will be by a monotone, by a single, harsh, cruel logic or illogic, call it whatever. There will be no freedom anymore. And all this kind of thinking, no, everything is good, everything is bonhomie, people should be so careful. It is, in fact, worse than even the fascism that Hitler could bring out. Only thing is, it has been stopped and stemmed at this point of time. And it's just that in our thought and feeling, we must know that it is a dangerous doctrine and philosophy. And this is nothing against the founder and the original philosophy. That's really irrelevant. But about how it is understood and practiced today. And he accepts, what I have said is not that the allies have never done wrong things, but that they stand on the side of the evolutionary forces. I have not said that at random, but on what to me are clear grounds of fact. So he has, he wrote about the poem on Hitler, the dwarf Napoleon, because Hitler was proclaiming himself that just as Napoleon represented France, he represents Germany and Europe. He was literally using that, just as he was using the word Arya, he was using the word Superman. And therefore, Shubhendu writes the poem, Hitler, the dwarf Napoleon, who has nothing of the Napoleon in him. And he says, Napoleon, for all his defects, was at least courageous. He was a man who fought in the front rank. But what Hitler is, full of deceit, receiving the voice of God again. But all his commands were by the Asura, called as the Lord of Falsehood or the Lord of Nations. And how the mother, it's a whole chapter. I think George von Reckheim has written very beautifully in a whole book, collecting all the documents. I think God of Hitler or something like that, the name of the book is. So it's a fascinating chapter, just like the Mahabharata at a much more mega scale. It is a Mahabharata of Mahabharata that Sri Aurobindo fought from his room, just as Sri Krishna sitting on the chariot was fighting the Mahabharata in those times. So here we see another avataric aspect of Sri Aurobindo. On one side, when Sri Krishna says, Yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata, abhyutthanam adharmasya tadatman shajameham. And then he gives that what is this abhyutthanam adharmasya, to restore the dharma. That we see in his writings through the Arya. Dharma is what would align us to the truth of creation, to the true law. And he does it through his countless writings. So that is one part. But paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam. This we see in the great Second World War. And of course his fight against the British, where all the good doers are released. They are shown a path, a new path. And all that is the forces of downward gravitation, which were represented during the time by Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini. And something of them continue to persist till today. And they are taking a brow beating one by one. And then finally he says, the divine takes men as they are and uses them as his instruments, even if they are not flawless in character. So the divine doesn't act according to everybody must be good. No, he can use instrument. I mean, Arjun had his own defects in nature. And this was a discussion going on once in Nalnida's room. Yes, he had his side. But yet, he was the person meant to become the hero, the Nar of the Nar Narayan. So the divine doesn't look at these things. Even if they are not flawless in character, without stain or sin or fault, exemplary in virtue or angelic, holy and pure, perhaps it's as good as saying that then nobody will be ever an instrument of the divine. If they are of goodwill, at one place the mother even says, what will God do with innocent angels? A converted asura is much more useful for God's work because he has that energy. Titanic energy, grandiosity. He can accommodate the grandiosity of God, provided he is converted, he is surrendered. But an innocent angel is a nice, very nice, sweet, but he has one little place like a butterfly. So he says, if they are of goodwill, if, to use the biblical phrase, they are on the Lord's side, that is enough for the work to be done. Even if I knew that the allies, I'm speaking of the big nations, America, Britain, China, would misuse their victory or bungle the peace or partially at least spoil the opportunities open to the human world by that victory, I would still put my force behind them. And it's quite likely that behind these nations, Shubhendu's force has gone, America, UK, France and China, all these nations which fought together. And probably now, of course, it has a term and things are waning slowly. And then there are wonderful letters. One of them is, of course, what do you call meditation? In this yoga, you don't find about meditation, but somebody has asked him that he used to meditate for hours. So people think meditation means closing the eyes and trying to meditate. So Shubhendu says, what do you call meditation? Shutting the eyes and concentrating? It is only one method for calling down the true consciousness. To join with the true consciousness or feel its descent is the only thing important. And if it comes without the orthodox method, as it always did with me, so much the better. Meditation is only a means or device. The true movement is when even walking, working or speaking, one is still in sadhana. And that's why Shubhendu made no distinction between this worldliness and other worldliness. He says, all the time I was engaged in outer activity, even ghor karma, but at the same time I was having other worldly experiences. So both of them came together, went together hand in hand, one enriching and completing the other. So he says, for me, all is Brahman and I find the divine everywhere. Everyone has the right to throw away this worldliness and choose other worldliness only. And if he finds peace by that choice, he is greatly blessed. I personally have not found it necessary to do this in order to have peace. In my yoga also, I found myself moved to include both worlds in my purview, the spiritual and the material, and to try to establish the divine consciousness and the divine power in men's hearts and in earthly life, not for personal salvation only, but for a life divine here. So this is how Shubhendu looks at. And there are some personal anecdotes. Nowadays, this thing is going on. Shubhendu, Swami Vivekananda, he showed him the way. And, you know, then people have a tendency to take it to any length. Now, in Shubhendu's own words, his letter, somebody has asked him, I was wondering if you had seen or met Vivekananda somewhere. Shubhendu's letter, very specific. No, not in the body. My contact with him was in the jail. When he was speaking with me for about 15 days, giving me the first insight into the intuition plane as the first opening to supermind. That's what is meant by he showed him the way to the intuition plane from where you can glimpse the supermind. Very clearly. There are people who say that he showed the way to supermind and he showed him the path, gave him the path, everything. So, and 15 days on a specific subject. Later on, Shubhendu even further clarified that on one of the letters of Nirodha, I don't know where, it must be somewhere among the volumes, but it's not here. So he says that it was the mental personality of Swami Vivekananda. It was not Vivekananda as such. And of course, he speaks about when mother has come and what it meant. One small little letter with which we can stop. We'll do it in two parts because it has many other aspects. It is not clear what your guru meant by my sitting on the path. Somebody must have said, Shubhendu is sitting on the path, was sitting on the path. People make all kinds of remarks. And somebody would have asked Shubhendu, imagine, disciples also great people. Huh? He is saying you are sitting on the path. And Shubhendu is not getting annoyed. Somebody else. Achha, this is how you think about your guru and you allow. And look at how Shubhendu writes. What a precision. What a sincerity. That's something so tremendous about Shubhendu. It is not clear what your guru meant by my sitting on the path. Look what he says next. That could have been true of the period between 1915 and 1920 when I was writing the Arya. He says, yes, there was a time when I was sitting on the path. What was that period when I was writing the Arya? Just imagine. But look what he writes then further. But the sadhana and the work were waiting for the mother's coming. I mean, I haven't heard something more beautiful, sweet, powerful, revealing as this one. But the sadhana and the work were waiting for the mother's coming. Namaste.